This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello and welcome to this CIO market update from LGIM. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Lauv, CIO, Colin Reedy, Head of Active Strategies, and Lars Krekel, Global Equity Strategist. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the pod.
Good morning, Max.
Morning, Max.
Good morning, Max.
Well, today we're going to examine exactly why the second half of 2022 has started on a decidedly more pleasant note for investors than the first 6 months of the year, with a focus on earnings season and the prospects for fixed income and equities. So with no further ado, Sonia, what do you think has driven the recent bounce we've seen in risk assets and of the many other noteworthy markets and macro developments since our call in July, which are at the forefront of your thinking?
Thank you, Max, and good morning, everyone. And as usual, before looking at the most recent market activity, it's probably worth recapping what has happened during the first half of this year, because there's obviously a lot of indications on what to expect and what to look out for. So the first half of 2022, and by now this shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone anymore, has been the worst start for both equities and bonds in decades. And it's in particular the positive equity bond correlation that has captured a lot of the attention, because it meant that for investors there was very, very little room to hide and there was very little to find positive returns. In fact, it's only been commodities on the back of the geopolitical situation that have delivered positive returns. Valuations have been collapsing. The S&P 500 has seen valuations go down by more than 30% at times. So again, something to bear in mind when we think about the forward-looking way for market. What's been the driver of this abysmal start to the year? It's clearly been the inflation narrative and central banks desperately trying to get ahead of the curve again when they found themselves very badly behind the curve at the beginning of the year. And we have seen the Fed in particular embarking on an incredibly aggressive hiking cycle in order to get on top of the narrative and demonstrating to markets that they can in fact control inflation. So the whole transitory debate on which of the inflationary pressures are in fact transitory, which ones are structural, is still with us. But what has happened when we saw yields peaking in mid-June is a very swift turnaround then from the inflation narrative to the growth narrative. And in fact, since the peak in mid-June, we have had long-dated treasuries having one of the best 2 month periods on record. So quite a dramatic shift, but again, important always to look at what has happened before we actually look at the positives. We have seen long-term inflation expectations, market-based expectations, now being much closer again to the 2% target of the Fed. And we have, in fact, seen the yield curve invert by as much as 44 basis points. So if you put the picture together, the market has clearly now kind of moved to the view that, yes, central banks can, in fact, control inflation. So what we need to worry now about is the growth outlook and whether and when and how bad the recession is going to hit the growth outlook. And hence, obviously, in that context, you have seen credit and rates move quite aggressively. And we have seen, obviously, equities in that context seeing quite a considerable bounce, because equities agreed with the view that the bond market was telling us, i.e. that central banks, in fact, are in control of the inflation narrative. And as such, it will be all about the growth outlook. But given, and this is why I've mentioned the S&P 500 valuation, given that obviously we've started from such oversold levels, Q2 earnings that Lars will obviously look at more in detail later, have not been too bad. And so you had a reasonable mix for risk assets to have a decent rally. Now, if we think, you know, what will determine the path of markets going forward, we will not get away from the two core drivers, right? Inflation. The most important question is whether, in fact, we have seen the peak, and we've just had the CPI data in the US that for the first time have given a good indication that it seems that peak inflation is in fact here, and that headline inflation in particular has seen a downward drift driven predominantly by energy. And it will come down to now looking at core inflation in particular, because in order for the market to get confident that the current priced hiking cycle of the Fed will indeed be effective, it will be predominantly around core inflation rather than headline inflation. And to our mind, this still is a risk because we simply don't know yet whether once we have seen the immediate retracement from the peak levels in inflation because of goods prices and because of energy, how much can the Fed influence the stickier part, i.e. shelter and services inflation, and hence obviously all eyes on the labor market. And that was the second data point we had this week. It was last week when we had the latest labor market report, which obviously showed an upside surprise in the tightness of the labor market. So it's two balancing factors here, which the market will need to digest. And the other big part is growth, i.e. is the Fed still right to claim that they can construct a soft landing? If you look again at the labor market data, you know, there is some question marks whether the current hiking cycle will indeed be enough to slow down the labor market. And you will need to slow down the labor market to have an impact on wage inflation. So the growth inflation debate will be the main driver again for the second half of the year. And I think the slight worry we have is that with this very distinct switch over from, okay, we are worrying about inflation first, now we're worrying about growth, probably has been too simple at its outset. And it will come down how this balancing act can be constructed for the second half. And I think at a minimum, we would expect more volatility to occur over the second half because the market will react to incoming data points until we have a much clearer picture emerging around the trajectory of inflation and whether, in fact, the market-priced path for interest rates is correct. And then secondly, and this is something Lars surely will pick up, whether the expectations for earnings is correct and whether the understanding of, you know, operational leverage, you know, slowing inflation and the impact on earnings is correctly priced, because that could be the other potential negative surprise that hasn't been factored in yet. Now, I've talked a lot about the US until now, and it's very clear that the picture in Europe and in England is, although very similar at the core, very much driven by other factors. And here, clearly, the geopolitical situation and the ongoing war in Ukraine have a much more direct and bigger impact on both inflation and growth, because the energy component in the inflation data here in Europe is far bigger and clearly far more impacted by the situation in Ukraine. Likewise, because of this, the impact on growth is far more direct and bigger as well, because the way consumers are hit by the current energy crisis clearly will slow down growth a lot faster and earlier than what we're seeing in the US. So for the ECB and the Bank of England, that's an even more difficult balancing act, because you have you're potentially hiking rates into a faster and more aggressively slowing economy. So not an easy one. But at the same time, headline inflation, because of the direct and higher impact of energy prices, clearly has seen peak inflation in Europe and in the UK in particular in double digits. So grabbing a lot of media headlines, and as such, not an easy one for those to square off. Hence, I think today is a fabulous session to look now at the different drivers for credit rates and then equities, because clearly there's a lot going on and the market is trying to grapple right now what the path is going forward for the second half of this year.
Well, thank you for that overview, Sonia. Yes, this is a great moment to bring Colin into the conversation to dig into some of those questions you've just raised. Colin, how much do you buy into that market narrative described just now by Sonia, which implies a dovish pivot by central banks? Are markets correctly pricing the policy outlook?
Thanks, Max, and good morning to everyone. It's great to speak to you right now. There's just so much going on, clearly, to talk about. To your specific question, I think we were surprised by the Fed the other week, both the tone and how the market read it. Don't forget, you know, the Fed has spent the last few months talking very tough indeed. They then get a 9.1% CPI number served up, and all of a sudden sound more balanced. That for us certainly dialed up the risks around yesterday's CPI number, which we now know was obviously better than expected. So Powell and the Fed currently look like geniuses. And markets are responding accordingly, as Sonia's alluded to. Strong day for risk assets yesterday, unsurprisingly, and opening up positively again this morning, which I think will further embolden investors. And I think crucial in that is the reaction at the longer end of the US Treasury market. It made sense to us. The 10-year initially fell from a yield of 2.8 down to 2.68 quite violently, before drifting higher for the remainder of the day, you know, to close more or less unchanged at 2.78. And I think that's what's encouraging spillover confidence today. So where does that leave us after a second quarter and a first half? Again, as Sonia's mentioned, this delivered a total return combination that clearly illustrated how much investors were unable to deal with regime change, you know, whether it was or just the prospect or fear of it. It wasn't the size of the drawdown, which was bad. It was the combination of both risk-free and risk assets, as we've discussed, you know, long-standing correlations breaking down. You know, we've spoken about this a lot of late, but the standout feature of financial markets for the last 30 years has been the mutually beneficial relationship between both equities and bonds. You know, when equities have gone through difficult periods, bond market has helped soften the blow by delivering an offsetting sort of positive total return. Not this time. We felt valuations, you know, were becoming compelling, but the technicals were dreadful. Outflows from within fixed income asset classes like EMD and high yield have been pretty relentless all year so far. So we needed some form of catalyst, and the US data in the last week or so seemed to have delivered that in the short term. On that flow question, I mean, getting accurate data is difficult, but I noticed one of the most more respected sources highlighted, I think it was at the end of June, that investors had sold $190 billion worth of bonds this year and bought $190 billion worth of equities. So the capitulation this year has been in fixed income, not in equities. And I think that's been a hugely destabilizing force. To some of the comments Sonia made, the overwhelming focus remains on the Fed and to a lesser extent, other central banks. Many are now expecting, hoping, forecasting a dovish pivot. We're still not sure, I have to say. Following last week's very robust labor market report in the US, you know, recession timeframes have been generally pushed back. It's got to be a good thing, right? And yesterday's CPI number will have, I would imagine, quite a few shell-shocked investors, you know, shouting about a potential return to a Goldilocks kind of backdrop. But we definitely think we need cooler heads here. You know, US inflation will not be under control until wages are under control. And controlling wages will require a looser labor market. And we're nowhere near that, Max.
Colin, do you mind if I jump in with a question there? You mentioned the pivot and the Fed, and we've talked about pivots a lot recently. Is the bond market pricing any differences between the central banks in terms of how they might perform that over the next few months or quarters?
Yeah, I think they are, Lars, and I think we would expect to see sort of increased tension and opportunities between, you know, US treasuries and other markets, because it feels like we're in very different places. The Bank of England, for example, got quite a lot of grief in the media post last week, some of which was justified, some of which wasn't. But, you know, imagine if that comment came out of the Fed. You know, imagine if they said, you know, look, we've got no choice. You know, yes, we get that, you know, there are recession risks, but we need to keep on rising interest rates. You know, that would be a much bigger issue for markets. It was ignored to some extent because, you know, Bank of England's not the most important central bank in the world anymore. I think with higher confidences around a European recession, you know, as you know, our economists have, I think that keeps them in a very different place as well. So yes, different places for the second half of the year, clearly, I think.
Okay. So despite the more positive tone, there's still a lot of uncertainty, as you mentioned, with more volatility likely. Speaking of cooler heads, Colin, how is the active strategies team navigating this still challenging macro and market environment?
I was actually checking my notes the last time I was on here, and you asked me that same question, and I think I said careful at the beginning of the year, and I can tell you nothing has changed. I would describe us as constructive on risk, long risk positions into, you know, I guess the end of the third quarter into September. We're happy to focus that more positive stance in sort of higher yielding parts of the credit markets, like high yield and EMD. I would think the scope for a sort of squeeze is greater in credit than equities, actually. There's just no supply in both high yield and EMD, given those outflows. So the you know, the supply demand relationship could flip quite quickly. From a duration and interest rate risk perspective, we're actually running very little duration again, following the recent data. We think it's hard for other investors to be convinced of a rapid deterioration in the US economy, while household income is as robust as it is, possibly even accelerating, actually. So we think it's unlikely that markets will be concerned about the very near-term recession risk in the US over the next few months. And that might, you know, mean they're focusing a bit more on some of the upside risks for yields, hence that low duration position. Having said that, within that, we have long interest rate positions in Australia and New Zealand, where we started to see weakness coming through in their housing markets and household consumption, genuine weakness there, actually.
Thank you, Colin. Let's turn to equities now. Lars, what have we learned from the Q2 earnings season, and what does this tell us about the market outlook?
Yeah, I guess we're most of the way through the earnings season now, and though we're still getting quite a few numbers of results every single day, but I think it's a good time to, you know, you can draw some conclusions from that already. So for me, the main takeaway is that despite all the talk about recession risk, and in some cases even quite imminent recession risk, there has been no sign of a broad-based earnings problem that has come out of the earnings season so far. So the Q2 numbers themselves have, by and large, looked pretty strong, I would say. Most companies have beaten analyst or sell-side analyst estimates, and they've beaten those estimates by, on average, 3.5%. And that's pretty close to the historical averages. So it looks pretty decent. And that puts U.S. companies on track for about 11% revenue growth, more than 8% EPS growth, a little bit of margin contraction in there, but generally above the historic trend growth rates for revenue and earnings. So yeah, I think by any measure, pretty decent numbers. The forward-looking parts of the earnings season or of the commentary we get from companies is almost maybe the more interesting bit. And I think there the message has been a little bit more mixed. If you look at the language that has been used on conference calls, that has been a little bit less optimistic than in previous quarters. So there have been more mentions of demand weakness, for example, things like that. And it's the same, really, with the more formal guidance that companies have given about the next few quarters. So not terrible at all, but definitely a little bit more cautious than previously. I would say, though, that, you know, that was to be expected largely, right? Company managements read the same news that we do. They have the same discussions about rising interest rates, inflation, recession risk that we do as well. So it would have been a bit strange or certainly a big surprise if that would not also have been reflected in at least a more cautious outlook. You know, there's just a lot of uncertainty, and that's been reflected in the outlooks. But again, yeah, I'd say the big picture is that there was nothing in the earnings season that shouts earnings recession is imminent. But having said that, I think we do expect earnings growth to slow down from here, probably grind to a halt by the end of the year. And then after that, earnings will only really fall significantly if the economy slows towards a recession. But, you know, that's our baseline expectation heading into 2023. So we would also expect earnings growth to turn negative in 23.
Lars, can I jump in with the obvious question? If firms, you know, suddenly find their pricing power somewhat eroded and inflation starts to head back to target, obviously, unless they can temper wage growth, which, as you know as well as I do, has never happened outside of a recession, we obviously head into a fairly nasty margin squeeze. Really interested in your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I say margins have been the weak spot for companies. Yeah, so I think that is fair to say that has come through in the earnings season, the last couple of earnings seasons as well. We've seen that inflation does boost revenues via higher prices. Of course, it also raises costs, like you said, not just the labor costs, but all sorts of costs. So there are a lot of moving parts for companies in the profit drivers. But the end result has been that earnings have been stronger, and that's also generally consistent with the historical experience. So as long as nominal growth is strong, as long as revenue growth is strong, you can cope with higher input costs or higher costs generally. And you might take a bit of a hit on margins, but yeah, your bottom line continues to grow somewhat. We have seen that margin contraction. I'd say the first thing to say about margins is always that yes, clearly they are important, but at the end of the day, we care a lot more about earnings, right? It's a price earnings ratio. It's an earnings season, not a margin season. So it's an important input factor, but it's not the dominant one. Margins specifically, I think it's just very difficult to see margins expanding from here, because most of the scenarios that we look at assume the economy slows down to some degree, maybe more, maybe a little bit less, but it does slow down. And even in a soft landing, you get that. And that means revenue growth slows down. And against that backdrop, it's just difficult to see margins expanding, even if the inflation pressures subside a little bit. So yeah, I think earnings growth is slowing down from here. And I think revenue growth will be the dominant driver of that rather than margins, though.
Okay. So some cause for comfort for investors, even amid a darkening outlook. Lars, looking ahead, how is the asset allocation team positioning on equities?
I wish I could say like a very positive and optimistic outlook, but I've already talked about earnings growth slowing down. That's not a great starting point for discussing equities. Yeah, you can get beyond that or you can overcome that, but I don't think this is the situation for doing that. I'd say the main message is that with the equity rally that we have seen, we have been reducing some equity longs that we have had. So we've been moving back towards neutral. And to me, the rally that we have seen still looks a lot more like a bear market rally than the beginning of a new bull market cycle. And that really comes back to the view from our economics team, where we, the view is that we get into a recession more likely than not over the course of the next year or so. And I think against that backdrop, it's difficult to bet at this stage on a fundamental recovery. And I would also say that prices have not moved so far, or sentiment has not become so bearish that you can say, you can argue that it's all priced in already. If that recession scenario plays out, I think there is still downside from here, and especially after the rally. So the risk is too big, I think, to add significantly to equities at this stage. So overall, like I said, we've reduced equity risk back towards neutral. That doesn't mean there aren't interesting things to look at within equities, though. An area that we still like is the tech sector. On a medium-term perspective, I think that's an area that will, independent of the cycle, continue to deliver superior earnings growth. And after the derating at the start of the year, I think valuations and sentiment look a lot cleaner there as well. And another area we like are defensive stocks in the equity space. So these are stocks that are not as sensitive to the economic cycle, that tend to outperform in recessions. Now, that may at some points be priced already, but the way we think about recession today, and if I look at what's priced in that part of the equity space, I think it is still underpriced. So I think that's an area where there are opportunities as well.
Good, thanks for that, Lars. Let's move now to another area of market focus, and that's geopolitical concerns, thinking, of course, about the conflict in Ukraine, but also tensions over Taiwan. Sonia, do you think we're moving to an increasingly multipolar world order? And if so, what are the implications for asset allocation?
So I think if you look at the current geopolitical and global backdrop, then I think one of the very clear directions of travel is towards a multipolar world. Now, having said that, this is nothing new, and we should not think that it's only since the beginning of the year and the invasion of Ukraine that this is an emerging scenario that is becoming increasingly likely, because we know that with the emergence of China as a global superpower. We've had the tensions between China and US ongoing for quite some time. And we always knew that this journey towards a new world order would take a very long period of time. But it's increasingly clear that we have seen, you know, another, you know, push towards an accelerated understanding of what this new world order might look like. And I think for us, it's very important to understand what the implications might be, not only just from a market perspective or in terms of the increasing levels of uncertainty, but, you know, if we think about global supply chains and the in the potential implications of a multipolar world, then it's very clear that for companies, eventually, it means that they will have to reconsider and think about where they operate, how they construct their supply chains in order to deliver the goods and services to specific markets. And that would be a significant shift, because we should not forget that ever since the end of the First Cold War and the fall of the Berlin Wall, we have seen such a dramatic increase in globalization with the relevant positive impacts of global GDP. This was all supported by the global information revolution and the way this has really shaped an understanding and obviously the formation of what we've gotten used to in terms of just-in-time global supply chains. We've talked for quite some time already around whether globalization has plateaued and whether now, obviously, on the back of what's happening currently, we would see an acceleration in the deglobalization or slowbalization or however you want to call it, and what the implications would be, particularly on inflation. But then likewise, obviously, as I've just said, on how companies have to think about their supply chains and, you know, whether we would see disruptions and clearly a move away from what have been probably quite fragile, we would argue, post the pandemic experience and the implications or the disruption we've witnessed on the back of this. And so although this is not an immediate scenario that we will try to embed in our economic forecast, we have now increasingly signals and obviously events happening. You've mentioned obviously the Taiwan situation and Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan, which clearly triggered a reaction function within China. This might be more the norm going forward and will clearly then accelerate the thinking across global corporates and how they might have to do this. It will definitely not be easier to navigate a multipolar world, and the chances of potential accidents or, you know, friction and tension clearly then will be far more normal than what we've gotten used to. But for us, obviously, as investors, it's more about the implication on the growth and inflation backdrop. And given that globalization has widely been seen as a deflationary force or a disinflationary force, it's logical that the immediate question will be, is this globalization or deglobalization in fact inflationary, and where will it hit the most? So we definitely will pick this up in our analysis to make sure that we have a good understanding, because as usual, it is a risk. There are threats, but there's opportunities as well, because it's those regions and those companies that will be able to adjust the fastest and will have a very good chance to benefit from it.
Thank you for that long-term perspective, Sonia. Colin, back to monetary policy. How do you think the ECB's transmission protection instrument, aimed at curbing fragmentation risks within the euro area, might impact eurozone credit markets? Is it up to the task?
Is it up to the task? Well, yeah, we think it's big enough, first and foremost. But I think the key point for us is that it's permanent. We were worried, I think, that it was going to only be presented as a mechanism that would be in existence until the end of 23 or 24 or something like that, in order to appease, you know, some of the ECB hawks. But it would appear they are far too focused on inflation risks to worry about, you know, the permanence of a tool that they clearly don't intend to use. You know, with all these things, you know, if you can look longer term enough, you know, you can cite moral hazard and, you know, influence on markets that isn't helpful or welcome and tends to come with unintended consequences. So I guess that has to be a concern. But, you know, remember, OMT, you know, has never been used either. You know, the ECB is a fantastic record, actually, when you look back. You know, words have been enough. You know, they currently hold the three most important words ever uttered by a central bank, which is whatever it takes, and that was enough to stop the European sovereign crisis, if you remember. So, I think it does a good job of reducing the tail. Nothing will ever remove it entirely, particularly with Italy, such as the structural and fundamental issues there. And I guess if I'm really getting into the detail and critical, there's a lack of clarity, I suppose, at this stage as to what would cause it to be activated. But overall, it's been a calming force, and you know, has been helpful to sort of European peripheral spreads.
Very interesting. Thanks for that, Colin. Lars, on the fiscal side, the Biden administration has seen significant progress on its so-called Inflation Reduction Act. How important is this initiative for investors?
Yeah, I think the answer to that really depends on what perspective you think about here. The name itself, Inflation Reduction Act, is clearly a misnomer. It's not going to achieve a lot on that perspective, but that's politically motivated. At the market level, I would say the impact is also going to be relatively small. There will be some additional spending, clearly, but it is spread out over a decade. And there will also be quite a bit of offset with tax increases in other parts of the economy. So the $430-odd billion gross number may look impressive, but the net effect of all of that on the wider economy, on corporate profits, should be relatively small. And our economics team, just to give you an idea, did not change their US GDP forecast on the back of this bill passing. So having said that, though, there will be significant impacts and significant positive from this package. It's a big win for clean energy, for decarbonization. So there are some parts of the economy where the impact is far greater, and that's because a lot of the spending number that I've mentioned, in this case over 80%, is going to be focused on one smaller part of the economy, that's clean energy. So via tax credits, direct investments, grants, loans, etc. So here is a big net positive. Stocks have responded in that way as well. So decarbonization is a medium-term theme that we like anyway. And part of our investment case there, part of our core assumptions, is that when regulatory decisions are made, that they will, on average, not necessarily every single time, but on average, that they will skew towards more green policies rather than less green policies. So yeah, it's encouraging to see that this has happened here as well. And particularly in the US, I would say, where we have been talking about fiscal packages for quite some time now, but there has been a lot of gridlock and very little progress had been made previously. So the fact that the only area seemingly where Democrats, even within their own party, could agree to increase spending has been on clean energy, I think is quite encouraging from that decarbonization perspective. So, yeah. Not a very big macro impact on GDP, but very good news for the environment and also for decarbonization investment needs.
Lars, just bringing it slightly closer to home, do you think there's scope for greater fiscal largesse in the UK with changing political leadership, you know, a much bigger cost of living issue, particularly around energy prices? Do you see fiscal stepping in there?
I guess, the short answer I'd say is yes. And it's not just a UK specific topic. I think we're seeing that across developed countries, really. And if you just think back to the experience from the pandemic, I think from a political perspective, your conclusion would be that fiscal spending to ease economic pain works as a political strategy, right? It helps get you reelected, and it's quite a different experience there. To the austerity policies after the financial crisis and the political response there and the rise in anti-establishment parties as well. So I think the political conclusion is that this has become part of the toolbox now, and we should expect it to be used in crises, certainly, and arguably even in economic slowdowns a lot more easily than it would have been in the past. So. Yeah, I think this may play out a little bit differently in different countries, and the political dynamics play a role there. In the US, maybe actually it might be some of the most difficult places to see that happening. We do expect after the midterms for more gridlock in Washington. It seems very likely that the Republicans would at least take control of the House. That means gridlock. So there, outside of a crisis, it seems much more difficult to get fiscal spending. The UK has so far maybe been at the slower end of increasing spending, and the leadership contest hasn't helped. So we'll see if that clears up a little bit in the next month or so. And European countries have also done a lot. So I think the broader trend is really that across developed markets, we should expect fiscal policy to play a bigger role in cushioning economic pain now and probably in future cycles generally.
Sonia, we've covered a huge amount of ground today, as always, from the power of words to the advent of a multipolar world and decarbonisation. What are the key takeaways for investors, and is there anything else you'd like to add?
Thank you, Max. And I would like to pick up what Colin referred to right at the beginning, the idea of a regime shift, because that will help investors understand and guide the relevant actions going forward. Because I think what was very clear from everything we discussed today is that there is still a level of uncertainty that makes it very difficult to forecast a relatively clear path from here. The inflation growth debate will continue to determine how markets will react to it. But it's very clear that with the stakes so high, any given data point can really kind of shake markets and create a level of volatility and potential dislocations that, again, investors need to be prepared for, but which will create opportunities as well. And I think you heard both from Colin and from Lars that the reading and the understanding of tactical opportunities is a key part of the way we are currently looking at our portfolios. That having said that, it's clear that then the longer term picture is not a lot easier, and there will be severe implications from what's going on in the world. And again, it is very important to start trying to understand and involve those implications into the analysis. And until we have a clearer picture emerge, in particular on the growth outlook and whether, in fact, the priced interest rate hike from central banks will be sufficient to slow down the economy, I believe there is still opportunity tactically to engage. But it's very difficult to outright position for a scenario because we don't have the clarity yet in order to do so. But it is with markets having corrected that much, clearly we shouldn't ignore the opportunity set. And, Colin used the word constructive. Lars, again, has mentioned, obviously, the opportunity we saw in equity markets in mid-June. So, again, it is important to not write off markets, but at the same time, make sure that you incorporate the risks and the uncertainties to a good degree.
Thanks, Sonia. Well, finally, as we always do at this time in the podcast, I'd just like to ask you what you've been watching, reading, or listening to recently. I'll get the ball rolling and say I've been powering through more of the Anthony Trollope Palliser novels, and on the last one, which is called The Duke's Children, which is all about a former prime minister and his woes. Sonia, what have you been consuming recently?
Given that we've decided earlier that Jurassic World doesn't really qualify for the podcast here, I shall share the reading list for my upcoming holiday, which one I'm sure many of our listeners might have read already is Prisoners of Geography by Tim Marshall. And the other one, actually very much aligned to what we've discussed today, is Putin's People by Catherine Belton. So hopefully getting some insights from there.
Absolutely. Thank you. Colin?
Reading, this is my only credible answer to these questions, I'm afraid, is 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World, which is written by a commentator in the US called Fareed Zakaria. Spoiler alert, we're old and more than a little bit lost as a society, but it's excellent.
Okay, another meaty recommendation. Thank you. And Lars?
Yeah, I was going to say I've been catching up on the Star Wars series on Disney Plus, but given if Jurassic Park is off limits, then I guess Obi-Wan Kenobi is as well. But beyond that, been starting to dip my toes into the Hardcore Histories podcast series, endless hours of them, and surprisingly fascinating. You can just lose yourself in them for many hours. Yeah,
that's a great point on which to end this month's call. Thank you, Sonia, Colin, and Lars, for your time today. And thank you to you, our clients and listeners, for joining us. Our next edition of the CIO Call will be in September, when we'll be joined by Madeline King and Amelia Tan to talk through ESG trends and responsible investing. In the meantime, you can find our latest updates via our social media channels on the LGIM blog and, of course, here on LGIM Talks.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal and general investment management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website, lgim.com. Copyright 2021, Legal and General Investment Management Limited. All rights reserved. No part of this publication may be reproduced or transmitted in any form or by any means, including photocopying and recording, without the written permission of the publishers. This material is issued by Legal and General Investment Management Asia Limited, a licensed corporation, BBB 488, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission, for professional investors only.